ministry. It's a little bit different in some ways and stressing some things that we may not be used to. Is this better? Okay. So what I'm going to ask Tom to just I'm going to ask a few questions. I want you to be thinking about questions, things you might be interested, explain a little bit more of what he's doing. And one of the questions I had, Tom, was in reference to orality. You use that term this morning. That's not something we necessarily use in our everyday vocabulary. And so what are you meaning by orality and kind of the ministry? Can you explain what is orality a little bit better to us?
There are two means of communication. You can communicate with someone using print media, or you can use oral means. Print media entails being able to interpret words in the alphabet, and you should be able to put it down on a piece of paper and store it there. In oral communication, everything is stored in songs and drama, and everything is handed down orally, no written document. So whatever you want to give someone, you do it by speaking. He has to be able to see it, he has to be able to hear it, and he has to be able to speak it. So we store it in drama, songs, and probably dances.
Okay, so drama, acting it out, hearing it in ways that it's memorable. Mm-hmm. You remember that. Okay. Explain a little bit more of how world cultures differ in maybe how they think differently than us, and their maybe even their worldviews, somehow that may affect. So how does an oral culture, a culture that primarily does everything orally, differ from maybe us?
There are some things that we do that are the same, but they are just done the same and different at the same time. For example, when we talk of education, we know that for someone to be able to get education, he has to go to a classroom, sit down under a teacher, a qualified teacher for that particular subject, and he has to sit under instructions for, let's say, for years or months or hours. In oral communication, they also do education, but they do it under a tree. That is their classroom. They do it under an instructor, and in this case, the uncle or the aunt. Dad also does some instruction. Mom also does some instruction. But these people are qualified to do the instruction that they are required to do. So an uncle is always qualified to train someone on how to become a good dad, a good husband, and how he can take care of his family. When it comes to young ladies learning things like cooking and going into the bush and gathering food, that's the responsibility of the mom. When it comes to them learning on how to take care of their family, that one is done by the aunt or the grandmother. So the instructor is qualified to do what he's supposed to do. So they have a curriculum, the way we have curriculum in the normal education system. They have a teacher, a qualified one, the way we do in the normal education system. They also have a classroom, which is under the tree. And they always meet probably in the evenings around the fire. When they sit around the fire, then the uncle comes up and give them training. It is passed orally. They also do have examinations that they take. Examination, you go and do what you've learned. And once you do it well, you've passed.
Okay. So maybe that's something we ought to implement, that you don't pass until you go do it. Right? So difference in how they learn, how they process relationships with aunts and uncles and family, people who are qualified or skilled, but more of a relationship versus going to a class at the university.
let me expand a bit on the worldview. It is important that before you talk to someone about something that is foreign, you should be able to understand his understanding of what you are going to talk to him about. When we do worldview, we ask the people what they believe about God. Because you might find out that your God, your understanding of God, is different from the understanding of God. And in Africa, if you tell someone that I want to talk to you about God, they will automatically allow you to do so. Because we are trained from childhood to give respect to someone who wants to talk about God. So, we might have a different understanding. Like amongst our culture, I come from the Luo people group. I came into a documentation which was wrong. A missionary put it down and said that Luos used to worship sun. But what was happening was that when a Luo man woke up in the morning, he thanks God for the day. But since we didn't have watches, we face the sun when the sun rises. So the missionary was watching this Luo guy waking up in the morning, facing the sun, and speaking. Then in the evening, he would face the sunset. Then he speaks again. But the missionary saw the movement, but he never bothered to find out what this man was saying. So he concluded that Luos are sun worshippers, which is not true. We worship the true living God. But how do we, okay, when do we do that? In the morning. What shows us that the day has started? The sun rises. So whatever we do during the day, in the evening when the sun sets, we thank God for the day. So we've never been sun worshippers. But it is wrongly documented like that. So had he taken his time and understand our worldview about God, our worldview about worship, he wouldn't have made that mistake. So it is important to understand people's worldview. Another thing is the issue of sin. What is sin to you is not sin to other in other cultures. For example, amongst the Samburu, the tribe that we have their clip here, if you want to get married, you have to steal your neighbor's cow, your neighbor's cattle. That's going to be your dowry. So you can't take from your family or you can't take your own animals to go pay dowry. You have to steal from your neighbor's cow. I mean from your neighbor's home. When his son is also ready to get married and to pay dowry, they will also come and steal from someone. So stealing of cattle is not considered sin amongst the Samburu people. So when you talk of sin, you have to explain it very well to them until they understand it. Otherwise, you might find yourself approving of what they are doing. Get the devices from South Africa and they are all empty. There's no content inside. So what we do in T4, we develop the content. Once we develop the content, then we load the content into the devices. Now, the process of content development is very crucial because if you do it poorly, then it will not be accepted by the people. So the first thing we do, I spend 6 months. Once we've identified a people group, I spend 6 months and try to understand them. During that process, I understand their language. I don't fully get it, but I get as much as I can. Second thing, I get to understand what their belief system is. So during the 6 months period, I develop the worldview document. Now, in every culture, people will tell you what they think you need to hear. When you are a missionary, the people you are working with, they will not tell you everything about them. They will tell you what they think will not offend you, the things that will make you happy. You might live with people for even 20 years, but you don't think that you've really understood those people. So for the 6 months I am with them, I try as much as I can to understand them. Then once I develop the worldview document and it's ready, then I go to the Bible and come up with a set of Bible stories. The first set of Bible stories are always 35. And this set of Bible stories are foundational. Mostly they are from the Old Testament. And I tell each story. I let them retell the story. Then I give them the opportunity to dramatize the story. Then turn the same story into a song. Then when they sing, they dance. Now, that content is what we put in the device. So our first year, which is Cycle 1, always has 35 Bible stories. That's the Bible content. Then every community always have like community issues they struggle with, like malaria, HIV, AIDS, clean water. I remember among the Samburu, they don't want to drink clean water. They don't want to purify their water. They get it direct from the pond and they drink it like that. Then they tell you, well, water is water. Our ancestors were drinking this water. We'll drink it. So it has been a struggle trying to teach and train them on how to purify water and drink clean water. Now, we put all of that in the content and then we give the device out. So content development, loading the contents into the device and then distribution. I always start with 20 people. The 20 people whom I train. Once you get the 35 stories, you go out and start a storytelling center. Now you become the storyteller and you only tell the 35 stories that you've learned. After 1 year, then I add the second phase, Cycle 2, and then Cycle 3. So at the end of 3 years, you shall have close to 200 stories, both Bible content and community development or humanitarian content. So T4 Global gets the devices from South Africa. They also help with the distribution and are part of the content development funding. So T4 Global is an oral-based community development, church planting, pastor training organization, and it's based out of Dallas, Texas.
And these devices are solar-powered devices that can take and run anywhere on the sun.
Yeah, it's both solar-powered, and then you can crank them. Always, for us to identify a community, a friend somewhere maybe knows about a group somewhere. And then we always tend to partner with a local church group there. You always find that there is a group of Christians who want to reach maybe that particular people group, but they don't have the method, they don't have the strategy, and that is where we come in and give them the oral strategy. So sometimes we get invited, like in Egypt. When I was doing training in Darfur, there was an Egyptian missionary with a youth with a mission in Darfur. So he came to attend our training and he liked it. When the government kicked him out and we kept on corresponding, he told me that maybe we ought to consider doing something in Egypt. Then I told him, I don't want to work in Cairo. I want to work in a rural setting where rural folks are. Completely unreached people. Then he said, okay, we can go to Alexandria, in the suburbs of Alexandria. There is where his wife came from. So in September, I'm going to Alexandria. I'm going to meet with the village elders, talk to them about what we want to do, and then we'll start the program amongst them. So we can be invited, we can identify ourselves, or we can use a friend who wants to reach someone but he doesn't have the methodology. Almost everywhere in Africa, in the city setting, people have access to education. Way in the village, there's none. And you will easily find an Arab who cannot even read the Arabic alphabet, an Arab who cannot even read the Quran. So in Egypt, it's entirely going to be Arab outreach, and you're going to do it open. In Khartoum, we do Arab outreach, but it is underground because Christians are being persecuted in Sudan. So we always look for people who have not gotten access to the Word of God in a written form. First, not everywhere we go we target the Muslim world. We have a donor who donated money to T4 Global, and he said he wants his money to be entirely used amongst the Muslim peoples. So that's why we are doing North Africa and Middle East. Then someone donated money for Southern Sudan. Now, in Southern Sudan, we have people who call themselves Christians simply because he's called William or James or Jacob or Peter, but he has never been to the church. Those are lost people. So we partner with the Sudan Presbyterian Evangelical Church for Southern Sudan project. So mostly any people group that has never been reached, we go to them, be it Muslim or non-Muslim. Now, back to the Muslim world. Muslims don't have a problem with the Bible stories. They don't have a problem with the creation story. They don't have a problem with Adam and Eve. They have a problem when you go and start telling them that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, at that point, the door is closed and they run you out. So, with them, we start with what they like. Okay, once you develop the worldview document here, and then you have your set of stories here, there is a gap here. So this gap, we always identify the bridges and barriers. Anything that will help us get the stories to the people, that is our bridge. Anything that will be a barrier, we don't go that way. So if telling them that Jesus is the Son of God, we don't rush there. We start with what they accept. And by the time you talk about Jesus, they shall have had or gotten close to 100 Bible stories. And the one you give the first set, you tell them to go out and share. So when you come to Jesus, they don't see Jesus here. They see or get the trail. Because even God himself did not start salvation by just dropping Jesus. When you read from creation, you can follow slowly, slowly until Jesus. So Jesus was never just instantly introduced to the human race. God gradually did that. And that is where chronological Bible storying is important. Because now you follow that chronology and you come bit by bit and you connect the stories until you come to Jesus. Now when you come to Jesus, and you tell stories about Jesus, building on the Old Testament stories. Now, when you ask someone that, are you ready to accept Jesus? At that point, you are giving him the opportunity to say yes to what he knows and understands, or say no to what he knows and understands. So, we don't start with what will make the doors closed. Now, there is a debate going on is Islam a religion or a way of life? We are debating that. Now, I did a training in Peru with a mission society. They are fully convinced that Islam is not just a religion. Islam is now a culture. Now, can someone be saved and still remain a Muslim? That's the point we are pondering now. The Mission Society believe that you can be saved and still remain a Muslim. At that point, they are approaching Islam as a culture, as a way of life, not as a religion. Some people are saying, well, you can be saved and remain a Muslim, but certain things must change. And you say, yeah, because we even have people who call themselves Christians, but they are not saved, and you don't need to entirely leave your culture in order to embrace Christianity. So we are debating those, and we want to bring the change in a way that will make sense to people. And we are very, very much careful when we deal with our brothers of the Islamic faith. I think it helped. Like even a worship service. What is the Christian way of conducting a worship service?
We don't know.
So you go to Africa, they sing, they dance. To some, that is evil. You go to mostly the Arab world, they have their way of singing and dancing. You go to Ethiopia, they mostly sing when they are seated down. Now, can we still have a church where people sing while seated down? Can you worship God singing while seated down? Yes. Can I worship God jumping up and down? Yes. Can I worship God quietly? Yes. Which is the best? Yeah, when we identify a group, then I go in and always look for the man of peace. This is a person that is highly respected in the community. He can be a village elder, he can be a chief, he can be a government administrator. A person that when he speaks, the village respects. You can go to the market. Always there are open-air village markets. You can go to the market, see what's going on in the market, and then you can buy like a pumpkin. You can buy a pumpkin from them. Then that pumpkin, maybe when you walk, you see a child walking on the street, then you give the child a pumpkin. Tomorrow, you go back to the same market, already a relationship has been built. Many a times I wear a t-shirt inside, and a shirt out. And when I go to those markets, I remove my shirt and give to someone. And they will be happy to wear a shirt from you. They will keep that shirt until there is a celebration, like a child has been born, they are celebrating the birth of a child, or they are having a traditional wedding. Then he will be so much happy to wear your shirt. Now, at that point, a relationship has been created and has been built. So, you look for the man of peace. And if you start it wrong, then you mess the whole thing. So the man of peace is always the person who will summon the people to come the first time. He talks to them about what you want to do. And then himself, he will identify another person who will be like the link between you and the community. So the man of peace is to introduce you to the community, and then with the blessings of the elders, they give you another person whom you will be working with every day. I don't speak Arabic, but in Khartoum, I have a guy who speaks Arabic, and he's a Sudanese. So everything I do up there, I do with him. In Southern Sudan, I have a different person. In Khartoum, I mean not Khartoum, in Egypt, I have a different person. In Kenya, I have a different person, although I'm Kenyan. But still I have a person who helped me do that. So this person will always help you monitor the progress of the work when you are away. And you can always correspond with him and then get the information from him. Every African country, there are big or large groups, large people groups, and small people groups. Now, in Kenya, there are about 5 or 6 main tribes in Kenya. All these main tribes, they have a written Bible in their language. Now, when you do Kenyan statistics, you find that they said we are 42 tribes in Kenya. Actually, we are over 50. Because they would take one big tribe and take a small tribe here and combine them and make it one. Like, we have the Maasai. If you know anything about Kenyans, Maasai are the guys who always jump straight. And they wear red clothing. And people think all Kenyans are like that. Now, the sub-tribe, we talk about the Samburu, according to Kenya statistics, they are classified as the Maasai, but they are not Maasai. We've recently found out that they took like 4 or 5 sub-tribes and made them to be Maasai. They speak different language, they have different culture. So the Samburus are forced to read the Maasai Bible. And they don't speak Maasai. So they have to learn Maasai. So we look for like a group like that. So we have written Bibles in languages that are spoken by major tribes. And then we have these small tribes that don't have any Bible translated in their dialect. And the SIL always start with the major tribes. We go to the small tribes. Because even if a tribe has got only 200,000 people, they need to hear about Jesus. Then there are some places where we work together with the SIL, because translating a Bible takes so many years. We agree with them. As they work on the long-term project, we do what is needed now. So our language, which is Luo, we have 3 different translations in the Luo language. Not every Luo can read even the Luo language. So not all Luos have managed to go to school. So if you want to do orality amongst the Luo, then you go way in the village and find Luos who cannot read and write. But this is again what we've discovered. Even in the big churches in Nairobi, where people carry Bibles to church with them, they don't read them. They only carry the Bible because it is a tradition that when you go to church, you carry a Bible and an hymnal. So people just carry for the sake of carrying. Some evangelical churches, before the pastor speaks, he always asks, oh, who brought his Bible with him today? And people with their Bibles, they wave them up. So some just carry the Bibles because they don't want to just sit there when everybody's waving his Bible up. But I've found out that even those who can read and write and they carry their Bibles to the church, they don't read. In fact, they are going to listen. They are not going to read in the church. Difficult because in most oral cultures they depend on one person to tell them what to do. So if the like the village leader or the clan leader decides that we don't behave or we don't conduct our things that way, then the young generation just obey that. That's one neat thing about oral cultures. They have respect for the elders. Whatever they say, that's what everybody's doing. So we will also find that the family structure is so much knit together that what young people struggle with in the city, they don't do that in the village, because the next door neighbor is your aunt, the next door neighbor is your uncle, the next door neighbor is your brother. So you are not going to sin against your brother. You are not going to sin against your aunt. So the families are kind of knit together, and so many things are decided by the elders. So the young people, our responsibility is to say yes. And the decision that that elders make are always the best. Swahili is the national language, but it has not even gone half of the country. It started from the coast. Now, when Arabs went to settle in the Kenyan coast, they got natives. The natives there, they were the Bantus. Kenya, we are divided into big clans. Like, we have the Bantus. Then we have the Kushites. Kushites are found in northern Kenya and they go up to Ethiopia and Somali. Then we have the Nilotes. Nilotes followed the River Nile. They came to Lake Victoria and settled around Lake Victoria. So in the Nilotic group, we have the Highland Nilotes. These people, they are animal keepers and they also do some farming. And mostly they are the Kenyan runners. So not every tribe in Kenya can run. Only this one particular tribe can run, the Kenyan Highlands, the Highland Nilotes. Then we have the Plain Land Nilotes. These are mostly animal keepers. They do no farming. They are the Maasais you see around, the guys who jump. Then we have the River Lake Nilotes. And here you find the Luos, our tribe. We are fishermen. We do fishing, we do farming, and a bit of animal keeping. Now, when Arabs came and they settled on the Kenyan coast, they found Bantus there. Then they intermarried. When they intermarried, the child who was born could not speak Arabic and the native language. So the children kind of mixed the two and that is how Swahili came up. Now, they are trying to nationalize Swahili. For the Nilotes, they have different dialect, they have different accent. Pronouncing some Swahili words is a problem. So they say, well, we can survive without Swahili. So Swahili has gone not beyond Nairobi. After Nairobi, that's Western Kenya, they are struggling. So we have a national language, which is Swahili. We have official language, which is English. And then each tribe speak their own mother tongue. That's why I'm able to speak 3 of Kenyan and then 2 of Sudan. And I picked these 2 because when I worked in Sudan for 7 years, I was able to pick their language. Yes, I can take Bibles back with me, and I will have to use the Bibles like in the church where I pastor. It is not an oral church. It is a literate church. So we read and write because that's the means of communication for that particular congregation. It's in the city, and people can read and write. But they can mostly read and write Swahili. A few can read and write English. So our service is conducted in Swahili. Yeah, our project in Sudan, especially Northern Sudan, is a very sensitive one. We don't always put it on a clip, and we rarely talk about it. It is in Darfur. Darfur is northwest Sudan, and I think people know Sudan because of what's going on in Darfur, the genocide and the Janjaweed militia. So for me to go in, I fly from Nairobi to Khartoum, and I get my visa to enter Sudan. They only allow me to stay in the capital for 3 days. If I want to stay more than 3 days, then I have to register with the Department of Security. So I pay $50 for my visa. Then in Sudan, I pay $150 for my security permit. Then, if I want to go to Darfur, they give me special travel permit to go to Darfur. And I cannot stay in for more than 7 days in Darfur. They want to know what I'm going to do. And I tell them, I'm going to train church leaders. They don't have a problem with that. So once you go in, then they monitor you. Are you really training these people on what you said? Or maybe you are a spy for someone. So when they looked at my passport, I have American visa, I have Australian visa, I have Ugandan visa, I have Egyptian visa, and they are going, well, you go to all of these places, and there are some countries that you go to that you don't allow their people to come to Sudan. So are you sure you are not a spy? And I tell them, well, I don't spy. So they tell me, okay, go, but we'll keep an eye on you. So I went and I did the training, but they were kind of following me. So what I do, I can post on Facebook that, okay, I'm in Sudan. And then after like 2 hours, I'm in Dallas. After like 2 days, I'm somewhere. So they tend to follow what goes on online. So I kind of confuse them like that. But at the end, the government knows that I was in and left. During that time, they burnt churches in Sudan. They burnt some of the churches there, and they just said, okay, no more Christianity. We've had enough, and they would just go to a church compound, burn it down, bring a bulldoze the whole building. And then they erect a mosque there, or they sell the land to someone and develop it. When I was in Richmond a couple of weeks ago, I read on the newspaper, the government has decided that they were not going to permit more construction of churches. They are saying that when the country separated, now Southern Sudan is a different country. When the country separated, then Christians went to the south. So, the few churches that are in the north are enough for the remaining Christians. So they are not going to allow more construction of churches. And they're serious about that. You've also read about this lady who they wanted to kill because she got married to a Christian and they asked her to denounce Christianity and she refused. Okay, finally she's that, and I think she's here in the U.S. She came recently. Now, those things are common. But what they are trying to tell the international community is that we tolerate Christianity and we have people who are coming. But once you've gone and done some work, they make sure that they destroy it. Now, in Darfur, when Islam began in Sudan, it began in Darfur. Okay? Now, Darfur is a very sensitive place for the entire Sudan. Now, when I went to do this work amongst the Darfur people, first they told me that the Darfur people are Arabs, but honestly, they are not. They are African. They are Sudanese. Second, they had made the Darfur people to believe that God only speaks Arabic. So children have grown up knowing that Allah speaks Arabic, not any other language. So when I first got my 20 guys, and I had done the worldview document with them, and we had the 35 original set of stories. So we were doing the stories one by one. So we came to the story of the Tower of Babel. And when we were discussing languages, one elderly guy asked me, "Tom, what language does God speak?" I knew from discussing worldview with them, they believe that God speaks Arabic. So I asked him, "If God comes now, there are 23 of us here, when God comes now and he wants to speak to me, will he speak to me in full language?" And he said, "No." Then I asked him, "Why?" And he said, "Well, you don't know full, so God cannot speak to you in full." Then I asked him, "If God wants to speak to you, will he speak to you in English?" Then he said, "No, because I don't know English." Then I told him, "God will speak to you in a language that you understand. So if you speak full, God will speak to you in full." And that changed everything. He insisted that I affirm to him that God can speak full. And I told him, God does not only speak full language. He speaks other languages too. So if you want to communicate with God, you are free to communicate with him in full. And if he wants to talk to you, he will do it in the language that you understand. In and for this case, you speak full. So after the training, he asked if I would allow him to pray in full. And for the first time in his life, he was able to speak to God in the language that he understood. And it was full. The following day, they said, "Okay, now, no more interpretation from English to Arabic. Let's have the lessons interpreted direct from English to full." And that changed everything. And from there, they know that God speaks full. The other thing that has brought changes amongst the full people is the way the war in Darfur has been conducted. For example, the government displace the poor people because they want to drill oil. So the poor are saying, well, this is our land. We are going nowhere. And the government is saying, yes, but we want oil. So they are displacing them, and that's what the war in Darfur is all about. When they kill the natives, the poor people are killed by the government, the same government that imposed Islam on them. So the Janjaweed, these are militias on horses. They go and they burn houses and they say, Allahu Akbar, and they slaughter someone. And God is great, and they slaughter someone. So the poor people have been asking themselves, these people brought us this God. And they are using the name of the same God to kill us. Something must be wrong somewhere. When Islamic relief organizations take in relief, they only give to Muslims and not Christians. And they make it clear, we are feeding Muslims only. If you are a Christian, you stay away. When Christian organizations bring in relief, they give to everybody. So the elders are asking themselves. They tell us that Christians are our enemies, but they feed us. And when our people bring food, they don't give to these people. But sometimes, you know, you are a Muslim, but a Christian is your uncle. The Christian is your aunt. So when they don't give Christians, simply means that they're not giving to your uncle, they're not giving to your aunt. So recently, they just told the Muslim relief organization that if you're not going to feed everybody, including the Christians, we don't want your supplies. So in Darfur, we have you've seen changes in the hearts of the people, and we've managed to train 110 Bible storytellers. We have close to 300 storytelling centers in Darfur. They meet in the houses, they meet in the homes, and they meet under tree. And every week, we have over 100 people gathering, hearing Bible stories. And that project has been going for 2 years. We are now doing the epistles with that project. In September, when I go in, we are going to continue the epistles and then finish the rest of the New Testament.